maybe part of the fascination for me was the fact that it is polytheistic, which growing up was just entirely foreign to me. And the view is a little bit different, in which it doesn't teach that we're sort of in servitude to the gods, but rather we're allies with them, and we should strive to be working together, just as we strive to work together with our fellow men and women.
Welcome to Chasing Leviathan. I'm here today with William Roundy, master of Farseer metery and whimsical fiction, and just really glad to have him here today. I've really enjoyed our conversations online. We met through a Twitter writing group, and he's always been incredibly encouraging, and he's on his way to publishing a book and finishing up a draft, getting that all started, and just from what I've read, I really enjoyed it. So, William, glad to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me here. An honor.
So, tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now. What do you have? You mentioned something about the Farseer.
Yeah, Farseer metery is still in the baby steps phase, I'd say. Really, just locking down good recipes that are consistent. We want every bottle to taste the same.
Oh yeah, quality control is super important. I have had my fair share of craft brews that probably one of my favorite beers of all time, it was peat smoked scotch ale.
Ooh.
And then it was phenomenal, and then I got it again another time, and as you can guess, not incredibly cheap, and it was like water. It was so bad. It went from like being one of my favorite beers to like tasting like one of the worst beers I'd ever had. And I was just like, oh, quality control is a thing, great. Especially for a small operation.
And I'll try not to throw names here, but I've even had that with some commercial beers where, I get some and I really like it. And then the next time I go buy a case, it's just the best way I can put it.
When I was in grad school, I definitely did that with PBR, which it was so cheap that when it was bad, like it didn't really matter. There were times I had it. I loved it. It was really good. It was like sweet and nutty. And then other times I had it and I was like, this tastes like 50 cent beer. Anyways, I digress. Yeah. William, you want to tell us a little bit about, today we're looking at the question of, how do we progress in our spiritual journey, and what should we look for? What should we look to learn? What are some ways to consider when it's? What are some things to consider when we are looking for change in our spiritual journey? So, as we kind of look at like these questions surrounding our own personal spiritual growth, tell us a little bit about where your story kind of intersects with that. Tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I was raised Mormon in Sudbury, Massachusetts. My dad's whole family comes from Utah, which is actually where we're living now. We came back. His family goes back to the sort of very beginning of the LDS church, and they're all pretty deeply rooted in that. And I was too, growing up as a kid. I think as is the case with most kids, I sort of just did what my parents believed, and I trusted in their judgment in everything, but especially in the realm of spirituality and beliefs. You always want to feel like your parents know exactly what they're talking about. And shortly after we moved to Utah, when I was 8, which was in 2005, the following year, 2006, my brother and his wife both passed away, which was the first time that I personally had to grapple with you know, questions of mortality and where we might go afterwards, if we go anywhere afterwards. And I think I had maybe a natural response of a little bit of anger.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of natural responses, and they're all okay. Yeah,
you just have to,
that's a difficult thing.
And I was young, and I was really close with his son. I still am really close with his son, who was 6 at the time, and I can't even begin to fathom what that must have been like for him, but you know, it was hard for all of us, and that was the first time I really started to question my own beliefs about things, and wondering what it all meant and what it was all for.
Yeah.
But I stuck with it for several more years, and I had really no intentions of leaving. I just wanted some questions answered. And once I started getting into high school, my friend group diversified, and I started to have more friends that weren't part of the Mormon Church.
And I'm sorry, forgive me. I just wanted to clarify what you said earlier. Was this in Utah or Massachusetts at the time?
That was in Utah.
Yeah. Utah, got it.
Yeah. So friend group diversified. I don't know how much you're aware about the LDS Church, but there are a lot of rules.
Yeah, I'm a little familiar. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, can't have coffee, can't have caffeinated teas. You can have caffeinated soda, though, which I always thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
But, you know, I met new friends that sort of introduced me to coffee, which at the time felt very taboo. And being a little teenager, I was all about that.
It is that age, yeah.
And the more I got into that and other spiritual and philosophical talks with those friends, I started questioning a little bit more and sort of losing, I don't actually know if I ever had my own closeness with the religion. I think I always sort of used my parents' faith as a crutch.
Yeah. I think that's fair though. As a parent with a 3 and 5 year old, there are so many things that you have to learn so quickly in order to become like someone responsible. Like, I mean, of course you take what your parents say. Your parents are also the ones who teach you, you know, how to eat at the table, how to, you know, not walk in front of a car on the road. So, I mean, I don't
exactly think
there's any, yeah, it's, that's how it should be. Like, kids can't make philosophical decisions on their own, right? That's not going to happen. So that all makes sense.
And yeah, that continued for a few years. That started when I was about 13. And then when I was 15, we took a trip to Italy, visited Rome and Florence, Venice.
And what prompted that? Just a family vacation?
Yeah, just family vacation, just getting out. But, you know, Italy being sort of the hub of Roman Catholicism, I got a lot more exposure to that than I ever would have in Utah, because I think I've spotted like 2 Catholic churches in the state.
That would make sense, yep.
Not a whole lot of options. And I was fascinated by that, partly because of the art and the architecture, but also just the sort of tradition and culture behind it all.
Yeah, it is imposing.
Yeah. In both good and bad ways.
Agreed.
But I found it beautiful. And so when I got home, I started searching a lot about that and just doing the deep dive on research and reading and video watching. And one thing that stayed consistent throughout my life is that if I'm going to research a specific spiritual path, I'm going to go all in.
Yeah.
Which I think
takes commitment.
Yeah, it does take commitment. And I think that that's been one of the strengths I've had in that regard. Long story short, I came to the conclusion that the Catholic Church was not for me, but I did gain a lot of respect for it in the process. I think it has beautiful traditions and obviously beautiful architecture and artwork and people.
Yeah, I mean, no one's going to, you know, talk about the Sistine Chapel and disagree with you on that part. Yeah.
Yeah. It is an amazing site. I mean, would recommend after COVID ends.
True.
Got to be safe about things. But definitely, if you can, check it out.
Is there, I just wanted to come back to, is there a particular reason that soda is okay over coffee?
Oh, I have no idea. Coffee's hot, I guess.
Okay.
I think that
is a difference. All right.
The specific wording behind the ban is like a ban of hot drinks, which I guess has been interpreted as tea and coffee. Hot chocolate's still okay. Hot, like, ciders would still be okay. Assuming that they're not alcoholic, of course.
Right. That so would, it's kind as of a meadery. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an important distinction for you. Yeah.
So that one's kind of a big gray area.
Soda?
Yeah, just soda. And like, what does hot drink mean?
Got it.
And it's sort of like, well, I guess we'll let the people in charge decide that. Whatever they say goes.
Yeah. Okay. I think I'm tracking with you. Awesome. So you just come back from Italy. And you studied Catholicism, decided it wasn't for you, but really had appreciated the depth of its beauty and tradition. And where did that take you?
I'm trying to remember the specific trail that led me to where I am now, which is still ever fluctuating and growing and learning. I don't remember exactly how, but I found some website about Nordic paganism. That really caught my eye and started reading about that. I'll actually link the site. It's Vieters Goffi, which is a blog. And
is that with two eyes at the end?
One eye.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, that really resonated with me. Felt kind of like I'd found my own little spiritual home.
What did you appreciate about it, if you don't mind my asking?
I think maybe part of the fascination for me was the fact that it is polytheistic, which growing up was just entirely foreign to me. And the view is a little bit different in which it doesn't teach that we're sort of in servitude to the gods, but rather we're allies with them. And we should strive to be working together, just as we strive to work together with our fellow men and women.
Really interesting. How, and I assume this is, you know, obviously we're looking at the 2000s at this point. And when I look at this, how did they view the gods? So as you were going through this, how were you viewing the gods? Were they avatars? Were they real incarnations?
So that's actually another thing I really appreciate about heathenry is that there's no specific dogma on that. You know, there are people out there who view the gods as literal, actual beings that exist out there somewhere. I tend to fall into that category, maybe just because I think it's a little bit more, for me, it's a little bit easier to connect that way. But, you know, there are plenty of people that think that it's sort of the idea that counts. And I guess, as some would put it, sort of just more of a way of life. That these figures are lessons that we can learn, but they're not literal beings. And I've always been drawn to that sort of diversification of belief and the okayness with it. You know, there is no specific dogma on just about anything.
There's no Nordic Pope that I just don't know about.
Not unless I don't know either.
This whole time, you're gonna get a letter in the mail. It's like, how did you not know about the Nordic pagan Pope? Really, really fascinating. Do you feel that in any way that, and of course, you know, feel free to do whatever you want with this question, but do you feel that in some ways that diversification of belief was kind of a reaction? Your appreciation for that was a reaction to growing up Mormon?
I'm sure it was. I don't think I ever consciously felt that way, but I'm sure that it played an impact. I mean, being Mormon sort of by necessity means being very ordered. And, you know, as I said, there's a lot of rules to follow and you have to follow them.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so than a lot of other kind of Christian denominations. So I'm sure that played a role.
Yeah. really, really interesting. And I think you said that you've kind of moved on from paganism. And what kind of prompted that?
I think I'm still there.
Oh, okay.
I'm still practicing, but I certainly still venture outside of it every now and then and explore other avenues, which some people may say is me not being true to my beliefs or true to my faith. I don't necessarily view it that way. I think it's sort of the ever-expanding quest for knowledge. I mean, within Nordic paganism itself, you know, Odin is depicted as this big wisdom figure that goes out and quests for knowledge. And so I think my doing that sort of just falls under that same realm.
Yeah, and I think that's people coming from a certain mindset and background, because if you come from a monotheistic religion, then you're going to have exclusive claims. But a polytheistic religion is going to be much more, I don't think forgiving is the right word. It's going to be much more open in terms of allowing multiple spiritual practices.
Yeah, no, certainly. And I mean, I have friends that, you know, really appreciate and respect Nordic deities as well as Gaelic. And I think that's great. Some people disagree with it, but I think I'm all for it. I think ultimately, my goal, apart from finding where I feel most at home, is just to gain more knowledge of other people's beliefs, and through that knowledge, gain more respect for them.
Now, you've mentioned that a couple times, looking for a home. Is that a major part for you, somewhere that you're looking for a spirituality that feels like a home? I mean, you kind of mentioned that, but what if you could describe what that concept is to feel at home in a spirituality?
That's a tough one. I don't think I've ever actually had to define that before.
No worries. Take your time. And you don't have to like hardcore define it. Like, I mean, this is as much about the experience of it as it is like hard and fast definitions.
I think, and maybe the whole reason that I even use that phrasing is, well, twofold. One, there's a lot of emphasis on family and home in Mormonism. And growing up with that, you hear it a lot. So I think that plays a role. In addition, I'm adopted. So I think somewhere subconsciously, I have always felt a yearning to sort of find where I fit in my family and, and in my life. That isn't to say that I don't feel at home with my family. I do. I love them deeply. But I certainly think that there's sort of a subconscious, I guess almost a sense of abandonment that you have to sort of grapple with. And, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I think my parents have been good about that as well. You know, they're both mental health professionals. My dad was a therapist for many years. My mom is still a clinical psychologist. So they've been able to, for one, handle the emotional side of adoption pretty well, but they've also been great at just defining terms and what is typical for adopted kids. And that's really opened my eyes. But I would say that's probably the two biggest reasons that I say searching for somewhere I feel at home.
Yeah. No, thank you. Is there anything about the what does home feel like to you? If I can put it that way. Are there any synonyms? Is there like a story, maybe a scene in your mind?
Maybe just comfort. And I know nobody is 100% comfortable in their spirituality all the time. I mean, hardship comes, and that always is a bit rocky, and sometimes that grounds you even more. Sometimes it has the opposite effect, and you know, makes you doubt even more. And maybe through that doubt, you come to be more grounded again. But
yeah, we definitely. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. I would just say comfort, a feeling of fulfillment.
Is there anything in terms of maybe even strength?
Yeah.
A sense of strength or source of strength.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, because I'm pretty sure the majority of people in our culture, I've been reading a lot about this recently, how we either have a doubting faith or a haunted doubt, you know, a doubt haunted by faith, because in many ways, we live in the last like century, two centuries, in a world where we have to justify our beliefs in a way that we really didn't have to. And that's the result of pluralism. Globalism and the spread of travel. Like, we're much more exposed to other peoples and other cultures. And it just makes it like, I mean, if you can imagine living in a village in France and your grandfather lived there, your great grandfather, your grandfather, your dad, and then you live there, and then you had like the church. I mean, it's not like,
that's what there is.
Yeah. I mean, even like you talk about like Nordic paganism, you found it through the internet. And it's not an option for like a 14th century French peasant.
Right.
Just makes for, and I think that's part of the reason why your journey is a fascinating one as you kind of walk through this. If I could go back just a little bit, just to satisfy my own curiosity, what is the difference between Gaelic and Nordic paganism or heathenry? Is there a difference between those two terms? Or
I tend to use them pretty interchangeably. Specifically, if I say heathenry, I'm talking about my Nordic paganism. And that's just a term that the community coined or took upon themselves. Really, it's just regional, though. Obviously, Nordic paganism is the polytheistic beliefs of the Nordic peoples, whereas Gaelic is more around Britain and, well, I guess Britain is more Saxon or Anglo-Saxon.
Well, you do have that weird mix, right? And then like even Gaelic extends in
Irish
some places.
And Scottish. And,
yeah. Even even if you go really old, you could even see some of it in France.
Yeah.
You know, like, and so that's, yeah, it's really, really fascinating. Are there different, I would assume so, but this is me just talking way out of my depth. Are there different gods?
Yeah.
To those two?
Yeah. Okay. I know a lot less about Gaelic beliefs. Victoria from our Twitter writing group is certainly more knowledgeable about all of that than I am.
Is that is it easy to kind of correlate and talk about not correlate, is it easy to practice Gaelic and Nordic together? Is there any kind of crossover that you can do there, or is it primarily you those two have to stay distinct?
I've never tried to practice both. I'm sure that you would get different answers from different people. I don't see any
It's a diversity of belief, right?
yeah, it is. I don't see any reason why you couldn't intermingle, though.
Especially depending on how you your view of the, you know, the metaphysical reality of the gods, right? Like,
yeah, if you view them as a concept, then at that point, you know, pick and choose as you like. Whatever suits your needs.
And so now you've mentioned that you were looking for a home. That's come up a couple times, but you've also mentioned that the quest for knowledge in the spiritual journey. And you said something interesting. You said about other people. And if you would like to elaborate on that, that would be awesome. And I was wondering if there is any other kind of knowledge that you are pursuing in your spiritual kind of quest or journey.
Now I'm trying to remember what I said about other people.
Honestly, you'd left it at that. You said, I like, you know, you mentioned that you like to you've explored other spiritual practices and avenues. And in that context, you mentioned that you like to, you like that in part because you get to learn a lot more about other people.
Oh, right. Yeah. To elaborate on that best as I can, as you've said, you know, with travel and globalism and sort of multiculturalism, we have become exposed to a lot broader beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, as is the case, I think, in all avenues of life, understanding is sort of the road to compassion. So if you can begin to understand about other people's beliefs that, you know, maybe you disagree with or are different from your own, it becomes a lot easier to view them as people instead of like other. And
yeah, absolutely.
I hope that I can always pursue that.
So for you, this is in many ways an ethical quest.
Yeah.
Primarily aimed at, you mentioned compassion. Really, really interesting. I don't know. Are you familiar with I believe it's called the Dunbar number?
Heard it, but I'm not super familiar with it, no.
And it was just a really fascinating concept to me, but they've done experiments and basically the human brain, on average, some people generally have more and so have a higher number, and some people have a lower number. And it appears that you can actually train your brain to have a higher number, but most people can only have an average of about 150 real social connections that their brain will adapt to. And everything past that, they will just stereotype people and not really treat them as people because their brain can't handle the complexity of it.
Interesting.
Which, I mean, really makes sense. Like when you talk to some people about, like when they talk about people far away and they don't talk about them as people.
Yeah. They just talk about them as a group.
Yes. And they just like, well, you know, and you can see many times. And I think that's really, from what I read, they had just started to even like suggest what like that training would look like. But it's even kind of interesting what you're saying here, this idea of, engaging in other people's spiritual practices, maybe as a way of like training yourself to be more empathetic, to be more compassionate. Obviously, like that brought that to mind.
Yeah. Well, and I think through learning spiritual practices, you also end up learning a lot of cultural practice. And, you know, whether we like it or not, spirituality has been a pretty core aspect of our lives throughout human history.
Still is,
yeah. But, you know, through that always has been and has influenced a lot of culture.
Absolutely. What are some of these other spiritual practices or avenues that you have explored and engaged in?
Oh, man. Well, I certainly will not claim to be an expert in any of these things.
Oh, no, absolutely not. What I'm more interested in why you choose them and even just your experience as you have kind of continued on this.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, definitely. Yeah.
I'm not asking you to be like a professor, you know, and be like, well, I went to one Muslim service. So let me tell you all about Muslims. Yeah. That's not the goal here.
Definitely not a theologian by any means. Let's see. Done research into Judaism, Islam. Both of those probably just because I grew up, for one, in a denomination of Christianity, but also in a very Christian nation, where, you know, where Christianity is the predominant religion overall. And Judaism and Islam are both, while different, sort of connected to that. So it was easy to take a look into that because there's a lot of familiar terminology and idea.
What differences did you find interesting? And I'm not saying, you know, you have to say whether, you know, it was right or wrong. Just what did you find illuminating? Like maybe the way they told, did you find that they told stories differently or the lessons they took from those stories?
I found a lot of Jewish philosophy really interesting. Specifically some philosophies about essentially not concerning yourself with the afterlife at all. Just like, just don't worry about it. Like live for today, you know, kind of try to build heaven here.
Which is really, I mean, you mentioned how the familiarity between the three, you know, they often call these the Abrahamic religions.
Abrahamic.
It kind of all stems from it. And that idea of, no afterlife and not worrying about it, or not necessarily no afterlife, but not worrying about the afterlife, is definitely unique compared to Islam and Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, growing up Mormon, that was such a huge thing. Like, you do everything in this life so that you can prepare for the next one. And I'm not saying that that's inherently bad, but I think for some, it can have the effect of almost like not concerning yourself enough with the life that you're living right now.
Not engaging.
Yeah, not engaging with it. You're sort of just like going through the checklist of stuff you have to do to get into heaven.
Yeah, it can definitely, I mean, forgive me, but speaking from my own experience, coming from a very conservative branch of Christianity, you definitely have that feeling sometimes of where people live their life like a checklist in preparation for something, kind of like, you know, the checklist they have before like flight takeoff.
Yeah.
And it kind of flattens life, and it a term, and I don't even know where I grabbed it from. I should probably look this up, but you know, you have small souled and big souled people, and you can sometimes get this very narrow, small soul feel. I don't know if that communicates what I want it to, but it really resonated with me. Like, it's difficult to explain, logically, what is difficult about people who don't engage fully with this life, but experientially they're not good people to be friends with. They're not good people to do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I totally understand. I think it's kind of easy to almost fall into the realm of like scrupulosity through that.
Oh, no, there's a word for the day. I'm definitely keeping that one.
Yeah. It's a good word. Which is interesting because through my research in Catholicism, obviously they have rules and you got to follow that, but scrupulosity is actually considered a sin. Like, if you're getting to the point that you're that hung up on things, then you're almost borderlining on obsession with that, and that's not a good way to live life either.
Would that be similar to like saying someone's a Pharisee or Pharisaical? Is that kind of in the same ballpark, or is it slightly different?
Throw me the definition of that.
So you had the group of people that were so caught up in being religious during the time of Jesus, and it was this group of scholars and religious leaders called Pharisees that they missed the Messiah.
Oh, okay.
They actually turned against him because they were so obsessed with the religion as an institution, as a code of law, that they missed the heart of, you know, what we as Christians would call the gospel, literally like right. God incarnate walking among them.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely in the similar ballpark.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's something that I really appreciate about this conversation. Something I really appreciate about you is that you in your search for knowledge are more concerned with finding God among us or truth than you are with the checklist and the edifice of, you know, what religion and the church is.
Yeah. There's another Buddhist sort of philosophy that I really came to like, and I forgive me, I completely forgot who said it. But the idea is, you know, there are many paths up the mountain, and the only person wasting their time is the one running around the mountain telling everybody else that their path is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's definitely very much, and it's been interesting to see for me that Buddhism has synergized well with other religions precisely because it has that openness to the quest for truth.
Yeah, and you know, you hear a lot of people say, well, it's not really a religion, it's a way of life, or it's a philosophy, and I really appreciate that because it has that ability to synchronize so well with other faiths and synergize.
And so even as you're talking here, is Buddhism another spiritual practice or avenue that you have explored?
Yeah, definitely.
Is there a particular branch? I know, and forgive me, I know that there is Zen Buddhism and I know that I've read of others, and I can't name them off the top of my head. Is there a particular branch that you investigated, or was it more just a general survey?
For me, it was more of a general survey, which maybe isn't the best way to go about it, but I definitely...
Well, it's just exploratory. Yeah.
It was exploratory. It was sort of the same thing when I started researching Hinduism, because there are a lot of different branches there as well, and a lot of different viewpoints in Hinduism.
What is your approach when you come to when you decide to look into a different spiritual practice or avenue? Do you come to it with kind of like the idea of evaluating it, of just kind of like sponging and just seeing what happens when you read? What is your goal? Is it just curiosity? But what's your goal when you approach these different spiritual avenues, these different spiritual journeys?
I think the core is curiosity. I'm a very curious person, and I really like to learn. I mean, that's even what got me into making mead or, you know, brewing beer. It's just like the curiosity of how it happens and what goes into that, and sort of also my fascination with whiskey. I've never made whiskey, obviously, but I've learned a lot about the process and different classifications and what makes what. And I think it's the same way with researching belief systems, at least at first. I think there is the underlying desire to figure out what this life is all about. I feel pretty comfortable where I am right now in that, but I still like to learn, and, you know, if I do end up finding something that calls to me more, than great.
And so you just continue to look and to search and to grow, which is honestly a lot more than could be said for many people. So I could definitely appreciate that. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here.
I appreciate it.
So you said this earlier, and it really piqued my interest. Did you, and I don't want to misquote you here, you said something about how making mead and beer was a sort of spiritual practice for you.
The mead specifically was, and that's why it's called Farseer Meadery. It's after the god Vidar, who is the son of Odin, and that's kind of one of his nicknames. A lot of the gods have a lot of different titles, and one of his happens to be Farseer, because he sees the future, but kind of keeps quiet about it.
Which seems a little bit of a jerk thing to do, but, you know, I understand that. I think, you tell people.
Yeah, I think the purpose is that he understands that things have to play out this way.
Yeah, and if you do say things, you can create more damage that way. I understand that, but
yeah,
it still doesn't make you feel good about it. Yeah, Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So how, in what way is it a spiritual practice? Is that something you do like in worship to Vidar, or is it like, forgive me, I know these questions are super ignorant.
No, not at all.
I have to confess, I don't know what I'm talking about with Nordic paganism.
I don't think
other than I've read the tales as a kid, you know, like,
they're fun stories.
Yeah. There are they're awesome. Yeah. Like the one where, Thor actually like scared the crap out of a giant, but the giant managed to save himself and happened to make it look easy. And Thor just kept getting angrier and angrier. I don't know. Yes. Well, the one where he pulled an invisible mountain in front of him to like block his hammer throw. Yeah. Obviously I liked that as a kid. It stuck with me. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, there's also the lovely story of Thor dressing up as a woman to get his hammer back. When it was stolen.
Oh, I don't know that one.
His hammer gets stolen by giants, and they say that they'll only give it back if one of the goddesses marries them. And so he dresses up as a woman and sneaks in for this wedding and gets his hammer back.
Yeah, it's funny. In a certain way, one of the things I appreciate about the Bible, and there's some similarities there, like the gods make mistakes. And then in the Bible, like people who you would expect, like they're literally, some of them are writing the stories about themselves. And then you have people editing it after, and everyone still is willing to leave in the mistakes that like Moses made.
Yeah.
Like when you talk about like the, one of the foundational kings of Israel, like David, it's like pretty sure, like if I was king back then, I would not have included I stole your wife and then killed you. Like that's like, and you're like one of my most faithful warriors.
Yeah.
That's like, that's not good press. Like, why is that going out? You know?
No.
And, but it's something I really appreciate. And I think is an important part of, authenticity. Both as a marker in religion of like, okay, these people like are willing to admit that they have flaws, but also to, you know, sometimes I think in Christianity, we like to skip the stories and not recognize the implications of, okay, like King David's like, not like, I mean, by today's standards, he's not a good guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and let alone Solomon.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So you go through there and it's just, there's actually, I have found a lot of hope with that though. And a reminder that like human beings are fragile and broken and yet still capable of great things.
Yeah. I was actually
going to, that led to me sermonizing. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're fine. And I was actually going to touch on that too. You make a good point. And one of the things that I was really drawn to in heathenry was the fact that my gods aren't perfect. And like, they don't pretend to be, and they're not all powerful beings either. They're not all knowing beings. Like they make mistakes. And for me, I like that because it's, I mean, outstandingly relatable. We all make mistakes and continue to.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Sorry.
To your earlier question about mead making, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a form of worshiping. The naming was definitely sort of a veneration or a reverence. I found a lot of, let me rephrase. While not required at all, a lot of people will end up kind of taking a patron god, the same way that, you know, some Christians take on a patron saint.
Yeah.
And it's just the one that you happen to relate with the most, and you sort of build that relationship from there. And that, I was that way with Vedder.
And he makes mead, so you decide to make mead.
He doesn't make mead, as far as I know. But that's why I named the
jump the gun.
Meadery Farseer was because of that. I suppose that the easiest way I can put it is, for me, making mead is a spiritual journey in the same way that meditation is a spiritual journey to some. While not a super lengthy process, it definitely takes time. It takes attentiveness. It takes care. I think another part of it is mead is, you know, one of the oldest alcohols known to mankind. It's something that my ancestors enjoyed, so there's something I can connect with through that and bridge the gap between ancestral and modernity.
Is that kind of idea of almost like getting in touch with your roots? It almost sounds like we're circling back to looking for a home.
Yeah, yeah, in a lot of ways. I think you're right. And ancestors, it's definitely an emphasis in heathenry. You know, we want to sort of stay in touch with our ancestors. Obviously not in a literal sense, but we don't want to forget where we came from.
So how has, and that brings up an interesting question, how does Nordic paganism view the afterlife? Or if it has an afterlife?
Yeah, so from my understanding, there are many halls of the afterlife. There are many places that you can go, one of which is hell, H-E-L, which is where the Christian term comes from. But in Nordic view of it, it's not a place of punishment like Christian hell is, so much as it is just a place of rest.
And forgive me, maybe I misunderstand this, but I believe that comes from like that whole bastardization of English as a romance plus Germanic, right?
Right.
And so you have this movement where it's like, this is what the word for afterlife is, which is hell, and then it's appropriated for the Christian concept.
Yeah, yeah.
which is just why English is such a confusing language. But no, anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Could not agree more. I love English, but man, does it have its problems. I'd say obviously the most well-known hall in the afterlife is Valhalla, which, you know, the Hall of Warriors and the Chosen who have fallen in battle, and the whole purpose there is that they fight and feast in preparation for sort of the end of times and the great battle that will commence then. I don't know about you. That's not necessarily a place that I want to end up. Doesn't sound like my cup of tea. You know, I like sparring. I like martial arts. I'm not super keen on fighting until I'm dead every day to then come back and feast and repeat tomorrow. Doesn't sound super fun.
I think you have to be a certain level of competitive to enjoy killing, resurrecting, etc.
Endlessly.
So, yeah. It's like, all right, I'm up, you know, 501 to 498.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like, you know, 501, 498, and then we had those three times we killed each other at the same time. I still don't think that, you know, I think you died first, so I think I should have gotten that one, but I'll still give it to you. You know, it's
yeah, it is definitely a certain kind of competitive. And I mean, culturally, it makes some sense for the time period, because obviously it was a, there was a lot of warring going on, and it was sort of honorable to go out and fight for your people and your tribe. And
yeah,
so I think from a cultural perspective, it makes sense that that got emphasized, because, you know, that's a, it's an honorable death and an honorable afterlife. And of course it's those picked by Odin himself to be in his hall. So that's also kind of, at least in today's society, I think a lot of people tend to bring prior Christian ideas into heathenry, which, you know, I don't have too much of a beef with.
But it's of course common. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Most people are coming from a Christian background.
Right. And because of that, you view, I mean, obviously Odin is the All Father, and he's sort of the chief of the gods, as Zeus would be in Greek pantheons. And so I can see how it's easy to sort of be like, well, obviously that's the best place that you want to go. You want to be in the chief of the gods, you know, top dog.
Oh, yeah. I want to be an acolyte of Odin, right?
Yeah. Whereas the reality is, there are many, many halls, and the general consensus is that you will land where you fit best. You know, there are halls for people who are really into poetry and writing and sort of the bards of the group. Like, there's a place for you there. There's a place for those who are into agriculture and farming. And to my understanding and belief of it, it isn't as though you're locked in that location for eternity. You know, you can intermingle what sort of your home in the afterlife is set up there.
To like go on vacation from your hall?
Yeah, go on vacation, visit other people.
My brother is pretty warlike. I'll go, you know, go see him in Valhalla.
Yeah.
You know, for a holiday, take a holiday in Valhalla. That sounds like a great short play. Not going to lie.
That sounds awesome. I love that.
Yeah. or short film. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned this, and I have felt this recently. I have spent, and I'm sure, you know, I know you've seen it on Twitter, and I don't know if you follow me on Instagram, but on Instagram, I posted it. I've been doing a lot of handmade pasta.
Yeah.
To the point that my wife, I didn't make it yesterday. And my wife was like, that was weird. That's the first day in like a couple weeks. Like, I was like, oh, it's PG's not making pasta.
Is everything okay?
Yeah. I know. It's like, what? You know, well, some of that was probably needed to take a break. And it is interesting. Like, there's a nutritional difference, as I'm sure there is with making your own mead. Like, there's a lot of stuff that you could just leave out that they put in for like shelf life.
Yeah.
And so handmade pasta, like, it sits differently. It tastes different. It's kind of like the difference between like the like Wonder Bread, you know. I don't know if you ever had like that.
Oh, yeah.
Wonder Bread and like fresh baked sourdough. Like those are they're two different things.
Two different entities, my man.
Yeah, two different products entirely. And it's very similar to that. Even as you were talking about making the mead, we've been talking about it in terms of spirituality, but when we talk about like looking for a home, I feel that with the pasta, I feel that I am grounding myself in the day by taking time and doing something slow. That sounds kind of what it sounds like we have, like there's some similarity there in terms of finding an older way of doing things that gives us a connection and groundedness both to the past and to our present circumstances where we are forced to stop and do something the long way and what ends up in many ways to be a superior product.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, I think, you know, that really ties to today and where so much of our life today is so quick and so instant. Like, I mean, we have Amazon Prime where now you basically don't even have to wait for shipping. We have fast food restaurants where you can get a meal in a minute, you know.
Yeah.
Even microwavable foods. It's just easy. It's quick. And I think for whatever reason, there was a mindset at some point in which we thought that quick and easy was better and maybe even more productive. And I think it's shown to be the opposite. In a lot of ways, I think it's more detrimental, generally speaking. You know, we get so used to that instant gratification that when we have to wait for something, it's almost more difficult than it should be. And, you know, I've started making bread as well at this point, and I love that process, especially because the rise time is so long. You have to wait 8 hours just to put it in the oven.
Yeah, my wife's been making it too. Yeah, it's definitely...
It's a process. Yeah. I don't recommend starting your loaf at 8 p.m. That's a mistake. But...
Yeah. So you're what would that be, like... 4 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock.
4 a.m. is when I put it in the oven.
Yeah, that's a bad time.
That was a bad time. But, you know, I figured if I'm going to be awake anyway, we might as well brew another batch of beer. So we did that.
Oh, awesome.
So that was cool.
Yeah.
Got a lot done that night.
I imagine so. There is something about the quietness between like 10 o'clock and 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Or maybe 11 and 5 o'clock where it's like all of a sudden... It's just so quiet and you're able to like really get things done. Yeah.
No, definitely.
I do like a lot of my best writing, and it's been difficult with our business. But when I really do get a lot of writing done is when I get up early and I start at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Now, part of that is I have kids. So like,
yeah, you got the
it's hard for me to take those. Yeah. The afternoons don't work too well.
No.
But, you know, it's even as... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. It's going to be a lot of that in this, I'm sensing.
No worries.
That's another thing I just love is just the quiet, you know. As a society, we tend to live in a place where there's constant noise of some form or another. With phones now, we can take noise everywhere that we go. But I think that there's great value in just sitting in quiet.
Yeah, instead of having those terrible people who make podcasts trying to get you to listen all the time.
Yeah, what's that about?
Yeah, man, it's terrible.
I love podcasts.
I know. I use them all the time too. Obviously,
I mean,
yeah,
I think they're great, and I don't think, you know, I'm not trying to say that we need to cut out all the noise, but I think it's good to take periods of just silence and just like sit with the natural sounds of the world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would agree with that. And I think like, even when it comes to like podcasts and stuff, like you look at podcasts or I'll find this with the TV, that it will, I'll put it on because the boys are being rowdy and then it will just stay on for a couple of hours because we stop paying attention to it.
Yeah.
And it just colors the whole afternoon in a really terrible way because it just like, it's just on and no one's really paying attention to it. And it's just noise and color and it's just a distraction.
It's like,
go ahead.
Nobody's paying attention, but your subconscious is paying attention and it sort of frames the way that you think about the day.
Well, yeah, it frames how you think about the day, and it really keeps you from any kind of deep thought.
Yeah.
Versus like sitting down and watching a documentary and paying attention to it the whole time, or listening to a podcast. Maybe while, you know, for me, I'll sometimes put on a podcast while I'm making pasta, and which, you know, kind of makes sense. You know, I'm like working with my hands, but those are two things that are easy to do together. But it's when you're trying to do like, if I turn on the TV at the same time, you're literally just asking for your brain to just like fry. It's like, that's not going to work at all.
Try listening to a podcast and watching a movie. Doesn't work well.
It's funny, and I feel like we're kind of coming full circle, but that idea of being grounded in things like making mead and making beer and making bread and pasta and these sorts of practices that ground us in the past and in the present really kind of serves as a metaphor and even a similar thing to what we're talking about this whole time. For me, I'm a Christian, and I have exclusive answers for a lot of things. But I'm also like, I understand that I'm not done growing, and I am okay with not having all the answers right now. And that's what I appreciate about you as you're talking about this. And one of the things about like when you're talking about fast food culture is that a lot of people feel that they need to figure out religion, like install it like a component in their life.
Figure it out
right
now.
And then just move on. Yeah. Like it's like, this is religion. This is what it does for me.
Download the file.
Yeah.
Go about your day.
Yeah. I mean, you see a lot of churches that are basically just social clubs with special programs for the kids and for the adults.
Yep.
And it does kind of go back to that idea we said about it's not scrupulosity because it's not so much that they're concerned with their overt faithfulness, you know, the picture of their faithfulness, not the real faithfulness, but it's not so much about that picture as it is about, like that consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
So we have like this different thing where you have, this consumer where it, like if Jesus walked in today, when you look at some of the stuff he did, would they recognize him? You know, if Thor walked in, would they like, even would they, they'd give him nothing but a glance from their phones.
Right.
And that's what something I really appreciate, and I think has come out a lot in that you have mentioned, is that groundedness is really important, and that sense of home and that sense of belonging, all guided by what you mentioned at the outset. And I wrote this down: understanding is the road to compassion, and so that really that we are seeking this kind of ethical and powerful community. Right. It's really, really powerful stuff, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Yeah,
definitely. Well, something that's stuck with me for years now. I mean,
the understanding is the road to compassion.
Yeah,
yeah. Where did you get that from? If you don't mind me asking.
I first heard that from Crash Course Psychology with Hank Green.
Those are great. Like those are such a great resource.
Yeah.
That's funny.
They're amazing. I'm trying to remember which one it is. It's one on the psychological disorders. It might be, I think it's the schizophrenia associative disorders.
And that's such a good example of what we're talking about here, is that we will often demonize people from other backgrounds instead of opening dialogue in the hopes of understanding them. And that it's easier to make a monster out of like someone who has schizophrenia or dissociative disorder than to really understand what's going on and through that understanding attain real compassion.
Oh, definitely. And you know, my dad works a lot with addiction, and I've learned that it's the same way there. It's easy to see addicts and be like, well, you know, it's their fault. They did this to themselves, and why should I care? But when you actually, you know, look at it through a trauma-informed lens, you see the full picture or the fuller picture. I think it's, once you do that, it's a lot harder to make a monster out of somebody.
And at the end of the day, what you're talking about is extending the same understanding and compassion that we could only hope for ourselves as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Well, William, really appreciate you stopping in and talking through all this. Really been a pleasure, and I've loved getting to learn a little bit more about you, and really have a lot to think about from this, and it's just it's helpful. It's helpful to have a different lens and to talk through and think through this kind of stuff. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah. Oh man. Every time I see you on Twitter, it's like, it's the best. I'll see like a little message and it'll be something that brightens my day.